Hello, and welcome to the AP United States History 2 podcast, where we will today discuss what you need to know about United States imperialism during the Progressive Era come May for your AP exam. So we'll start with the United States in the 1790s, where the United States will seek to start expanding westward and have a series of many battles with Native Americans. This is just some context that we need to understand expansionism during the Progressive Era. Now, expansionism can be associated to this man named Frederick Jackson Turner, who has this frontier theory during the 1890s that America will soon reach the end of the West, in other words, and, you know, approach the Pacific Ocean, and that we're not going to have enough room for Americans, and we're not going to have enough supplies in the room that we have to suffice for the American population. And so Turner is going to evoke fear in some Americans and some intellectuals who are going to think, wow, we need to start imperializing other nations in order to expand. And during the 1890s, we also have the Battle of Wounded Knee. And this further symbolizes what Turner was trying to express, because the Battle of Wounded Knee largely represents one of the United States' last battles with Native Americans over westward expansion. And it's a battle that the United States wins. And to those supporting the frontier theory that Turner suggests, the Battle of Wounded Knee basically goes and says, wow, the United States has essentially defeated U.S. Native Americans, and now where else do we have to expand? You know, who can we almost defeat next? But what lands do we have left to conquer in order to satisfy our growing population? But in addition to the frontier theory, because of course that is not all, there are more significant perspectives and ideologies that people have as imperialism motives. So we have the economy, we have politics, we have military strategy, and we have ideology. So to start with the economy, there's Americans saying, wow, we should open up foreign markets abroad for goods. We could do that through imperialism. And we also want access to cheap raw materials, which a lot of other foreign superpowers like England and France and Spain were doing with their own colonies, opening up foreign markets for goods and using those markets for cheap raw materials. From a political standpoint, we also wanted to compete with other nations, which we'll get into later over the Panama Canal. And from a military strategy perspective, we wanted to have sea lanes and naval forces. And that idea was largely associated with this guy named Alfred T. Mahan. And Mahan basically says that a nation is only as powerful from a military perspective as the amount of sea lanes and naval power it has. So the United States will seek to expand its sea lanes, which also ties into the Panama Canal, which we'll talk about later, by having these imperialist tendencies. Now, from an ideological perspective, there's a lot of religious figures pushing for imperialism across different nations abroad. So, for example, we have this concept of the white man's burden. And the white man's burden basically says that white men almost have a duty to go imperialize other nations and bring white culture and what they determine is civil to those nations. And that's going to be supported by people like Josiah Strong, who says that Anglo-Saxon civilization is superior, and that because it is superior, they have a burden to go spread what Anglo-Saxon civilization is to other potentially weaker countries in their view. And so that's some of the justification that people like Josiah Strong use when it comes to imperialism. Also, we're going to see some of the ideas of social Darwinism come into play here. Social Darwinism, as you might know from previous teachings about AP US history, is the idea that some people are born almost already better than others, or are meant to succeed in the social landscape because of wealth that they were born into. And it's the same idea here with Josiah Strong's White Man's Burden, where America is, you know, the top of this social Darwinism and was born into this top of the social Darwinism among other countries, and therefore has a duty to spread some of its ideologies abroad. So that's the imperialism motives and a lot of the context that we're going to have here that's necessary for the exam in regards to imperialism. Now, of course, the US is also going to have actions that are imperialist earlier on in its republic, Take the 1820s, for example, when missionaries from the U.S. are in Hawaii, the Dole family, a famous family, starts buying up land in Hawaii. And by 1893, 70 plus years later, there's a U.S.-sponsored revolt to overthrow the Queen of Hawaii and essentially make a new U.S. territory. So the U.S. is not unfamiliar with imperialism. However, what some historians consider the first major action of U.S. imperialism is going to be its involvement in the Spanish-American War. The Spanish-American War is obviously a war between the U.S. and Cuba and Spain, and at the time, during the 1890s, Spain controlled Cuba, and Cuba essentially wanted independence, but Spain did not want to give Cuba independence. It was a valuable territory to Spain, and as a result, Spain started building these reconcentration camps in Cuba to punish the Cuban population for their opposition. Now, one important name is General Butcher Wyler, who ran these reconcentration camps and essentially humiliated and punished the Cuban population, leading to the deaths of tens of thousands of Cubans. Now, at the same time, a lot of newspapers, of course, the U.S. is close to Cuba, so a lot of newspapers are reporting on what is going on in Cuba, and there's going to be widespread American sympathy for the Cubans who are suffering under Spain and General Butcher Wyler. Also, from an economic standpoint, a lot of American companies have sugar investments that are significant in Cuba that are supporting the sugar trade in the U.S. And we're also going to see yellow journalism come into play. Obviously, some of these papers reporting on Cuba want to make money, and so they're going to make money by exaggerating some of the events happening in Cuba to sell more papers. But that only further increases United States sympathy for the Cuban population. At the same time, however, we're going to see the DeLome letter. And the DeLome letter is essentially a letter that is uncovered in the United States that will drag the country into the Spanish-American War. And the DeLome letter is from an ambassador of Spain. And in the letter, the ambassador essentially disrespects McKinley. And this is going to frustrate the U.S. upon the discovery of the letter. It's the first time really that a U.S. president has been challenged in this regard. And so the United States says, essentially the population of the United States says to McKinley, like, you can't stand for this. You have to go ahead and do something. At the same time, perhaps the most important catalyst for the United States' entry into the Spanish-American War was the USS Maine. Newspapers will blame the sinking of the USS Maine as Spain's fault. It was unclear at the time, though, whether or not it was actually Spain's fault. But across the U.S., all of these Americans are saying, wow, Spain sunk a United States ship. This is unprecedented. We need to do something about this. And so the United States will declare war against Spain and enter the Spanish-American War. Now, this war will be considered the Splendid Little War. In fact, Secretary of State John Hay calls it that because very few soldiers die, and it's a quick war. It lasts just 4 months. And at the conclusion of the war, which the United States wins, the United States is going to have passed the Teller Amendment. And the Teller Amendment essentially tells Cuba that Cuba will retain independence. And that's something important to keep in mind. So a lot of the Cubans now are thinking, wow, if we beat Spain, then we'll get the independence promised by the U.S. on the Teller Amendment. And so the U.S. is involved in this war. We see George Dewey, for example, at the request of Roosevelt, crush the Spanish fleet in Manila Bay. We're also going to see Roosevelt form the Rough Riders, basically a quasi-militia that's going to go into Cuba and attack Spanish forces. And we're going to see that the war will ultimately end with the Treaty of Paris. This is a significant treaty. In the treaty, it stipulates that the United States will gain control of Guam, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, though the United States does have to give some money back to Spain. And all of a sudden, the U.S. is facing this question of what do we do with this new gained territory, right? We have U.S. Guam, we have Cuba, Puerto Rico, and we have the Philippines, right? And we've already made this promise to Cuba, but what about the other territories? And what specifically do we do with Cuba? Now, on one side of things, there's this anti-imperialist league who are going to oppose annexation of these territories that the U.S. has essentially just gained. For example, Carnegie and Mark Twain will actually oppose annexing these territories, which is pretty significant. These are big influential figures in Apush. But McKinley, on the other hand, is going to favor expansionism, and he is the one ultimately who approves the Treaty of Paris. So the Teller Amendment, however, following the Treaty of Paris, will have been replaced by the Platt Amendment. And one way to remember the Platt Amendment is it kind of, from the U.S. perspective, puts Cuba in its place, where McKinley wants Cuba to be, and where the United States at the time, the government wanted Cuba to be. And at the time, the U.S. government didn't want Cuba to be fully independent, because from their perspective, why would we take up this brand new territory? And so the Platt Amendment basically says that the United States can intervene when necessary to restore peace and order in Cuba. And it says that Cuba cannot sign treaties without the U.S.'s approval, and that the U.S. can maintain a naval base in Cuba. Obviously, that's Guantanamo Bay, which we have today. It's going to be similar across the other territories, similar laws regarding them. However, the United States will not grant any of these people citizenship, except for Puerto Ricans later on. However, there's a lot more in the imperialist saga that is going to happen with the United States beyond just the frontier theory, beyond the modus for imperialism, beyond Hawaii and the Spanish-American War, and the Platt and Teller amendments that we need to know for Apush. So tune in for part two, which will be coming out soon, and we'll focus on the United States' involvement in the Philippines and in the Panama Canal, and of course with Roosevelt's policies on imperialism and future policies that presidents such as Wilson and Taft will also have on imperialism. Thank you for listening in.